My name's Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education. And Tuesday evenings, as I think most of you know, is a long-standing weekly lecture series that runs straight through this fall until November 18th. I encourage you to check the website if you don't have the schedule down. If you're a member, you've received the quarterly publication in the mail, so you know what the schedule is. And then there are also rack cards by the info desk if you want to have something to put on the refrigerator. People still do that. Next week, we have artist Alan McCollum who here to talk about his methodically produced work that I think for a very long time now, since the 70s, has been asking big questions in quiet but insistent ways. I'm very much looking forward to that lecture. His work is represented in urban theater, New York art in the 1980s, by the piece Surrogate Paintings, which is something he became very well known for. So I encourage you to look into that if you aren't familiar with Alan's work, and to join us next week for what I think will be a very entertaining and very informative lecture. I have to tell you that Alan has already warned me he may go a little long. So I encourage you to eat a bite before you come. Urban theater, New York art in the 1980s is the topic of tonight's presentation. The Modern's chief curator, Michael Opping, has collected iconic works from important collections around the world to capture the mood, energy, and critical themes that distinguished the art of a highly complex, both disturbing and exhilarating decade in one of the world's greatest urban centers. If you have had the opportunity to see the exhibition, and I hope you have, and spend time with the work, you know that it touches on large themes of the time, and it is absolutely chock full of rich material for countless points of conversation. But at the same time, this exhibition is, in fact, a particular perspective, from a particular perspective. It is the way that Michael remembers it, based on personal experiences and also direct contact with many of the players of that time. And therefore, it seems like it would have been missing a real opportunity if we hadn't, in fact, opened this Tuesday evening season with an introduction to the exhibition by those who know best. And clearly, we made a good choice. All this star power has filled all those seats. Michael has invited Dr. Mark Thistlethwaite, who is the Kay and Velma Kimball Chair of Art History at TCU, to direct a panel discussion with himself as the organizer of the exhibition, and his cohorts, modern curator Andrea Carnes and assistant curator Allison Hurst, who both contributed essays to the exhibition catalog. Most of you know Mark Thistlethwaite, sitting on the my far left. You're far right, in this particular context, actually, because in his time at TCU, he has been a faithful supporter of this museum, contributing his knowledge on a variety of subjects in several Tuesday evenings over the years, including, in fact, the first Tuesday evenings at the Modern in 1979. I don't know if you knew that, but he kicked us off. I know. Impressive. And he was only 12 years old when he did that.
I was hoping you'd say that.
In a similar vein, I wanted to just go ahead and give Mark a shout-out and the Eamon Carter a shout-out because, in fact, he's very supportive of all the museums, and he is currently leading a lecture series at the Eamon Carter titled... it's such so interesting. Where did I lost it? Here it is. Water Matters in American Art, which sounds really interesting to me. And if it wasn't at 3 o'clock on a Wednesday, I would be there for all of them. But I've actually heard from others that it is very interesting, and it's no surprise. Michael Opping, of course, has put this museum and, dare I say, Fort Worth on the map with exhibitions such as the Philip Guston retrospective that many of you will recall was the first special exhibition in this building, Declaring Space, which featured the work of Mark Rothko, Barnett Newman, Lucia Fontana, and Yves Klein, and then the very popular Anselm Kiefer, Heaven and Earth, and that is to name only a few because we don't have time for me to go through the full array. Curator Andrea Carnes continuously challenges and excites us with exhibitions such as Pretty Baby, Hubbard Bursler, No Room to Answer, and most recently, the very well-received and challenging, in a good way, Mexico Inside Out. In addition, Andrea has brought us the ever-popular Focus Exhibitions, a program that she began with the when we moved into this building, and something that's been very popular, and we all appreciate the perspective that that's given us. Allison Hurst also gets credit for contributing to Mexico Inside Out. In addition to being of great assistance with the organization of the show to Andrea, she also published a conversation with participating artist Melanie Smith in the exhibition catalog. Most recently, Allison curated Focus, Fred Tomaselli, and she is currently working on the upcoming Focus, Jules de Balancourt, who, thanks to Allison, is giving the last Tuesday evening lecture on November 18th. So as you can see, you're in very good hands tonight, and without further ado, please join me in welcoming this esteemed panel.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming tonight. We'll try to keep this to about 3 hours, and so save your questions till the end, if you would. Let me first congratulate the three of you on a fascinating exhibition and really an insightful catalog. Both the installation of the exhibition and the layout of the catalog, I think, are really exceptional and perfect for the subject of urban theater, New York art in the 1980s. I'm going to start with Michael and pick up on something that Terry said about the personal nature of this exhibition. Any art exhibition is, in fact, a reflection of its organizer's point of view. But usually it's not stated so clearly that it's a personal point of view. And both the catalog states it, as well as again, Terry just mentioned, acknowledges it, the personal nature. And Michael's recollections of New York in the 1980s as a young curator. So my question for you is, can you talk a little bit about that aspect, the personal, and then why do an exhibition of the 1980s, and why do it now?
Well, 1980 was essentially 35 years ago. So if you're a 1980s artist, you would ask, if not now, when? But your question begs a certain response in terms of, I think there's a natural resistance to studying the 1980s. And before we talk about the art, I think it's good to talk a little bit about the socioeconomic aspects of the 80s. Tom Wolfe wrote a great novel called Bonfire of the Vanities that was about greed in the 1980s, not specifically about the art world, but about New York and in the 1980s. And along with these artists being a baby boomer generation entering New York in, say, 1980, 78, 79, 80, you also had a new generation of collectors developing. And they had decided that not only was art interesting, but it was also an asset class. It was an investment. And the artists were very smart. These were all art school, university-educated artists. They got it. They knew that remember, the president was Ronald Reagan. It was trickle-down economics, and it was trickling down into the art world in a big way. So we tend to look at the 80s through a slightly dirty lens, a slightly tawdry lens, as if, well, all of these artists did was make money and become celebrities. Well, I know a lot of artists right now who will get on a private plane and fly to Miami, Basel for an art fair and not complain one bit about it. And yet they complain about the 80s. And I think they complain about it because this is where it all began. The 80s, if you wonder why the art world and the art market is where it is today, look back to the 80s. So there's that aspect of it. And there were collectors in the 80s, and I'll shut up for a second here. I mean, one collector did say, and I think many collectors today would agree with this, but they would never say it, art collecting is the only socially acceptable form of greed. Anyway, so...
In the 80s, where were you? Were you based in Berkeley?
Yeah, I was in Sarasota, Florida for a time, and then I was mostly in Buffalo, New York. Oh. And Buffalo, New York spawned both Cindy Sherman and Robert Longo. And in the 80s, if you weren't in New York every 3 weeks, you felt like you missed a year. There was so many parties, so many things going on, and so I would say, just to cap off this question, it is a personal exhibition, but it's not totally personal. You know, art history, this is not a revisionist exhibition. I didn't approach this exhibition like, well, who are all of the important people right now who we didn't think were important then? This is an exhibition that is about the arguments that we had in the 1980s. Who did we argue about? Was Julian Schnabel more important than Cindy Sherman? Were the girls more important than the boys? I mean, it really got down to that, and we can talk about that a little later. So it's partly personal, but if you look at Art Forum, Art in America, if you look at the literature, you'll see that these are the artists that we argued about.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask Andrea and Allison. I imagine your knowledge and experience of the art of the 80s would be more conditioned by art history. And I wondered, what was your take on the 80s before you began involvement in this exhibition? And then maybe how did it morph as you worked on the exhibition?
Well, I was... Usually, as a curator, I'm sort of situating historically objects and other artists. Now I have to do it to myself to answer this question. But I was in undergraduate school in the 80s, from 84 to 88. So I was in Texas, but going to New York as often as I could. So at that time, for me anyway, art history, contemporary art, what was happening in the moment, was saved for the last day of class or the last two classes. So I didn't get a lot. I actually wasn't learning the 80s through textbooks, but I was lucky enough to get to go to New York and also to have artists for friends. And so, you know, in school, who I was in school with, and they were studying a number of different postmodern writers and texts, and they would tell me about it, and then I would try to wrap my head around it. But, you know, I think at the time I was just confused. There was so much happening, and it's hard to see a decade art-wise when you're in it. Mm-hmm. I gravitated towards certain artists in the 80s then, and those are the ones who I wrote about for the catalog now. But getting to look back at the 80s, you know, three and a half decades later, I see how influential that decade was. And I never thought it would be when we were in that decade. But artists in the 90s up to now have really, you know, kind of interrogated identity and certain things that artists in the 80s started.
Mm-hmm. I also learned about the 80s through the art history books. And certainly history is always reductive. And I was looking at the 80s through a much more narrow lens than what I would have been if I was living there in the middle of it all. But there are definitely certain artists that always really resonated with me and still seem completely fresh, even when I was learning about them years and years later. Those artists, I would say, would be Richard Prince, Cindy Sherman, Nan Goldin, for example. But yeah, I mean, I feel like through the research on this exhibition, through my research in school, I've learned a lot more about the 80s than what's presented in the art history books, and I feel like that's given me a stronger foundation to really understand the socio-political milieus going on and surrounding the art that was created during that time.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about when you're in a period and how you know it or don't know it. And I don't know, Michael, if there were artists that you were absolutely sure were going to be in this exhibition that wasn't even you know, in your mind at the time?
Well, no, it was very clear in my mind who needed to be in the show. I'm sure I've left out some people. You can't, you know, you only have so much real estate in a museum. And there are a few people that, you know, it would have been nice to have in, but couldn't do it. But you had to have this battle of, the 80s are a really complex decade. Much more complex than the 50s or 60s or 70s. There was no signature style in the 80s. There were theoretical viewpoints, and there were feminist viewpoints and male macho viewpoints. And the key was for me to try to set those things up again. I mean, you couldn't be in a bar talking with someone in the 1980s and say, you know, you liked Julian Schnabel's work and Cher Levine's. You couldn't do that. They would go, that's impossible. You can't do it. You can't cross them. Those wires don't cross. We will all explode if you do that.
Yeah. It was a decade of theory, for sure.
Which it was a decade of theory, but it was also a decade of a certain male macho group of guys who were trying to reinvigorate painting. So they're replaying abstract expressionism while a whole new generation of feminists and Richard Prince, you know, more theoretically minded artists.
Yeah. The artist Heinz Steinbach, who's not in the show, but made a comment that resonates, I think. He said that in the 80s, it seemed like the art world in New York was an archipelago with a lot of different islands and different things happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
What about, this is mainly for Michael, but jump in if you need to or want to. The exhibition catalog features a Keith Haring at work on the cover, and then also one of his paintings as well. And, you know, it's a great choice for something called urban theater, I think. And his work has remained highly visible today, even though he's deceased by many years. But in the 80s, and a lot of people maybe forget this, that the issue of graffiti as art was extremely contentious. Mm-hmm. And there were all sorts of writers. Susie Gaplick wrote a famous article about graffiti in well-lighted rooms in which she took museums and galleries to task for showing graffiti. Can you talk a little bit about that debate and that issue?
Well, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say I thought he should be thrown in jail.
We'll move on to the next question.
He was spray painting private and public buildings, you know, and I didn't, you know, it was a huge argument, you know, but eventually, as you saw this body of work develop, and as it moved into the galleries and got just a little more gentrified, you began to see how talented these artists were, Basquiat, Keith Haring, but at the time it was very contentious. And the title of the show, Urban Theater, that title is very specific. And I would have to say that graffiti had a big thing to do with the title. There's nothing more theatrical than graffiti. It's a late night performance with no audience. Goes out there at 2 in the morning with a can of spray paint, does a huge mural, runs away, and in the morning you wake up and walk down the street and there's this cinematic mural. I mean, that is urban graffiti. I mean, that is urban theater at its best. But
I would just add something to that. Another thing I think I thought about when working on this exhibition is that artists like Keith Haring and Sammo and, you know, the idea of graffiti was a zeitgeist at the time that manifested itself in different ways. And the equalizing effect of graffiti, the way you don't have to walk into an institution to see it, you just see it because you're out in public and you walk by it, was the same thing that artists like Barbara Kruger and Jenny Holzer were doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not necessarily saying they were influenced by graffiti, but it just occurred to me working on this exhibition that they were looking for that same equalizing effect, that same sort of democracy about who sees it. There's no hierarchy. All you have to do is walk by, because their works were in public too, of course.
Well, in 1980s New York, there was an urban renewal thing going on, and there were areas of New York that were getting cleaned up. There were areas of New York that were still totally dilapidated. And so someone spray painting some of these buildings was a very good thing. These landlords were not taking care of these buildings. And as Jenny Holzer once said to me, when I was talking, doing the show, I said, well, she said, well, Michael, when you talk about the 80s, it really depends on what neighborhood you're talking about. Because there were, you know, Julian Schnabel would sell out a three-gallery show. Mary Boone, Leo Castelli, and Speroni Westwater. Fill all three galleries, have one opening, sell them all three out. Then there were people like Keith Haring who couldn't get a gallery. So they were, it was equalized by them being able to go out in the street and make their art in the street. And the streets were synonymous with the clubs. You know, you would, in the 80s, you went to a lot of clubs, and you could go to low-end clubs, or you could go to high-end clubs like the Palladium. You know, which was, who was the guy who did the play? Not Rubel, but was it Rubel? It was Steve Rubel. And then, you know, you had CBGBs and these other clubs where there were poets, filmmakers, musicians. Every painter I knew, for better and worse, was in a band in the 80s. So there was this whole performative element.
But it was really... galleries hadn't shown graffiti before the 80s. No. So that was a big step that was taken.
And Patty Astor was a pretty, she was a pioneer in showing graffiti art, and she also had the first gallery in the Lower East Side, and really kind of not only promoting graffiti, but also promoting hip-hop music. She was definitely a pioneer in that.
Mm-hmm. Now, your essay in the catalog focuses on abstract painting. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that in terms of, I'm quoting from you in your essay, you note that it was a mode in the 80s, free to be coded with new meanings and signs. I wonder if you could kind of unpack that a little bit. What was new about it? How it was different from earlier abstract work?
Well, to make a long story as short as possible for this venue, the critic Clement Greenberg and also Alfred Barr, they were very critical in promoting post-war abstraction. They promoted it as, and I'm talking Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, etc., promoting abstract expressionism and abstraction as a purely formal and stylistic device, where the artist's emotions, the spirituality were also important, but that it was really about what was within the confines of the frame. And so in the 1970s, this kind of fell out of favor. The essentializing storyline that Greenberg had set up, it started influencing other artists, so they were kind of reaching this end game, or the death of painting being the grid or the monochrome. So Frank Stella comes in, and he completely takes the individual self out of painting and promotes it as an object, which then gets us into minimalism. Abstract painting was not a mainstream in the 1970s, so when the 80s rolled around, they felt like it was something that they could go back to and appropriate and fill with new meaning and codes, because it was something...
Flip ahead. Yeah. If you suffer from effects of strobe, don't look.
Back. Yes. So Peter Halley, he is with the Neo Geo artists. He's probably the most outspoken of them. He wrote many articles about it. He was really interested in post-structuralism theory, and he felt like he could appropriate abstraction and insert actual meaning into it, because it had become a purely formal device. He felt that pre-war abstraction, before Greenberg and Barr, related to historical context, but it had become a formal device. So he felt like it could be recoded with what was going on in culture and what was going on in, you know, contemporary living environments. He used geometry in a way that wasn't spiritual, as it was before, but used it in a way to bring attention to the fact that the world in which we live is abstract. Tract homes, tenement apartment buildings, these are all carbon copies of themselves. They become abstract. The simulated space of the video game, the computer chip, These are also abstract worlds in which we live. So bringing attention to that, he's bringing attention to the fact that abstraction is a new way of representation, and it underpins every aspect of modern life. He calls these cells and conduits. The cells relate to prisons in that they are modern-day isolation. We all sit in our rooms. We're connected by conduits or technological devices. We're more connected than ever, yet we're more isolated than ever. And I think his work has an interesting relation to what's going on right now as well.
Yeah, we're all prisoners of conduits.
Exactly. And artists like Ross Bleckner and Philip Taff, they were really mostly interested in appropriating op art. They felt that 1960s op art in particular was very empty of meaning. It was purely retinal. In this painting, Sanctuary, Ross Bleckner mimics the dots of op art, but what he's doing here is he's making a memorial to those that have died from the AIDS epidemic. Here, there are these bright, flickering, but very individualized polka dots that are amongst an otherwise darkened space. And so really he took op art because he felt like it was empty, and he inserted it with very intense content.
And he was one of the first to really address the AIDS.
He really was, yeah.
Andrea, your catalog essay is entitled Personality Complex. Why'd you choose that title? and from your perspective, what are the iconic works in the show that relate to that?
Okay. Well, Personality Complex is not really meant to signal the psychological disorder. It's more about the fact that these artists, the ones that I wrote about, and all of them really, were playing out life in New York City using a number of artistic personalities, really handed down from Andy Warhol, to kind of flesh out and explore the notion of gender. So, you know, there were numerous texts, feminist texts, postmodern texts, philosophical texts, psychoanalytical texts, swirling around the issue of gender, masculinity, femininity, and sexuality. And the artists who I wrote about all dealt with issues of personality in different ways. Some, like this image from Nan Golden, this is a self-portrait of the artist. From a confessional standpoint, so someone like Nan Golden used herself and her friends, or her tribe, as she called them, as subjects for her photographs, and she takes these unflinching, blunt looks at what's going on around her. At the time, she was involved with drugs, and she was involved with an abusive boyfriend. And the works are, you know, they show all of these aspects in this portfolio, The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, which is in the exhibition here, or 70 works from it are in the exhibition here. It's a span of time that speaks to an era and speaks to a place. For her, it was specific to the Bowery, where she and her friends of, like, the post-punk era, the gay scene, the transgender scene, hung out, and she just recorded life around her in images like this. And then there were other artists, like maybe Robert Longo or Cindy Sherman, who also explored personality, but instead of being confessional, they used a very impersonal avenue to explore personality. This is Cindy Sherman. Cindy Sherman always portrays someone else. She is the subject of her photographs, but she's always portraying someone else in her works. So in this series, her arguably most important series of untitled film stills, she personifies different archetypes of American women in film. And she does it from a very, unlike Nan Golden, a very impersonal standpoint. It's almost like we don't know where she falls on the line of parody or sincerity in a work like this, but it makes viewers think about themselves in relationships to what we see in Hollywood B movies or film noir and how that affects our self-image.
Do you want to mention this too?
I'll mention, this is Robert Longo. Robert Longo in the late 70s and early 80s was the boyfriend of Cindy Sherman. And this is Cindy Sherman in one of these images. These are his works that are in the exhibition from his, again, arguably most important series called Men in the Cities, where he looked to a Rainer Fassbinder film of 1970 called The American Soldier. There's a scene where the soldier is being shot, so his body is contorted. And Longo used his friends and posed them in photographs and then made charcoal drawings of those photographs of his friends, in this case, Cindy Sherman and another friend, in images that are, we don't know if they're in agony or ecstasy. The famous Longo quote is, "Are they dancing or dying?" We can't read their own emotions, but we see them in this kind of singular pose. They're alone, kind of this existential idea, but superimposed onto that is the idea of the urban creature in the 1980s and sort of the corporate branding, the everyman.
Mm-hmm. In thinking about issues of gender, but also I know, Allison, you've worked on institutional critique before. I was happy to see, because this is not actually in the show, but there's several works by the Guerrilla Girls in the exhibition, which is great to see. Do you want to comment on?
Sure. Well, the Guerrilla Girls were formed in 1984. They're an anonymous collective of women. They began on the occasion of the Museum of Modern Art's exhibition, I think it was called the International Survey of Painting and Sculpture, out of, I think it was 169 artists, less than 10% of those artists were women. So the Guerrilla Girls launched a poster campaign directed at critics, curators, gallerists, and artists to bring light to the fact that of the inequalities, the inherent racism and sexism of the art world. And it was done in the guise of advertising because it was quick, it was accessible. And so they staged protests, they postered everywhere around these museum shows, and we have a really nice selection of about 18 posters in the exhibition. But they really called attention. They called attention to the consciousness of the fact that there were these inequalities. And there's statistics saying that the Whitney Biennial of 1993 had the most women artists as compared to previous years, and also artists of color. So it seems like they really did have an impact. And also, as with institutional critique, sometimes it's co-opted by the institution. So MoMA actually owns quite a few of these posters.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I think I would also just briefly add to that artists like Sherry Levine, who I think we have a slide of that work, are redoing works. They're appropriating and redoing works by famous male artists to kind of, I mean, the question is it revisionist? Is it, you know, what is she writing on their coattails or pointing to lack of women artists? So this was originally a painting by the artist Man Ray of a fantasy billiard table. Levine redoes it as a sculpture. It has, you know, feminine attributes, the legs are curved, and then this rectilinear male playing surface, kind of a metaphor for women play supporting role to the man. So artists are doing these kinds of works as well.
And when you were talking about the Guerrilla Girls, the idea of the urban theater being very much the physical environment where you would find posters like this in the Guerrilla Girls and so forth. And the back gallery, if you haven't seen the show, is filled with a lot of these artifacts that are really fascinating to look at. Another group called Grand Fury. And also, if you look very closely in one of the glass cases, you'll see that Michael Oppin is an honorary member of the Guerrilla Girls. And we couldn't convince him to wear the gorilla head tonight. He's been mentioned by a couple of you, and I wanted to get your thoughts about Andy Warhol, who's sort of the eminent Greaves behind the 80s. Warhol dies in 1987, but it's almost like he hasn't. His impact is still so strong today. But in thinking about the 80s, how do you see his place in the 80s and the kind of significance he held for artists and the influence that he had for artists?
Well, he was critical. I mean, every one of these artists in this show, well, I shouldn't say everyone, but many of them really appreciated what Warhol had done. I mean, here's a guy who, from 1962, embraced the idea of celebrity in America, embraced the idea of artist business, of artists controlling their own destiny. You know, he is the person who said, in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. He had no idea about Twitter. No idea. And he was so right about so many things. And he did it in this way that was so, I don't know how to say it, androgynous. All of these... around 1967, Warhol had said, you know, I'm really tired of painting. All I want to do is television and film. And then in the 80s, these younger artists like Julian Schnabel, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Keith Haring, all of these guys flocked around Warhol and really ignited his idea about making paintings again. And it's this self-portrait is one of the great works in our collection. It's a little bit of an homage to Jean-Michel Basquiat's hair. And so there was a symbiotic thing between they were sort of reviving Warhol, and Warhol was sort of saying, these guys are good. These guys are really good. He got them all shows.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of celebrity looms large, and you deal with that mm-hmm. in your essay. And I don't know if you'd seen this work I put in at the last minute, but these are artists that appeared in Vanity Fair and Vogue magazine, as well as Art Forum and other venues, and they become these very much celebrity figures. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that, you know, Warhol, because he focused on celebrity, first of all, his own sort of status, making fashionable his effeminate and asexual gender attributes, you know, making that okay for himself. That's one aspect of what Warhol did, making himself an art star and the others around him. But then also dealing with celebrity and using celebrity as subject matter. A lot of the artists in this exhibition infiltrate everything through television and film and advertising to come up with their subject matter. And I think Warhol really, you know, if he opened a door to that, they blew off the hinges. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah.
The other thing about celebrity in the 80s is that, as we all know, celebrity is very fleeting. And Warhol made a lot of great quotes. And one of them that is less recognized is, I am a deeply superficial person. And deeply superficial, which means he understood what... And Warhol said, keep everything on the surface. Mm-hmm. Don't go behind the surface. And in doing this exhibition, I had to go back and reintroduce myself to a lot of these artists that I went to parties with and visited their studios, men and women. And in the 80s, the guys were out there, and they were big. Here you go. Vanity Fair, Julian Schnabel, David Sally. What's really fascinating was the women were far more anonymous. I mean, if you saw Cindy Sherman in this room, you would not recognize her. She is all of these other people, but she remains kind of anonymous. And someone asked me... a few weeks ago, so how was it going back and seeing all these people? I said, well, you know, the guys are still struggling with it. The women are over it. You know, they didn't get all of this in the 80s, so they worked through it and just worked on their practice and their career, where the guys got a little more hung up on celebrity, which I think distracted from some of their work. I mean, I hope this is not recorded, but but I think there are a lot of people that would recognize that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of celebrity artists, oops, what did I do? Oh, let's talk about Jeff Koons, because he is certainly a celebrity artist still and has a major exhibition, the last exhibition in the Whitney, the old Whitney. By the way, Michael Opping is curating the first solo exhibition, a work retrospective of Frank Stella's work in the new Whitney when it opens next year. But what's your take on Koons?
I hated Koons. I hated him.
And most
there were a lot
did.
Of people hated him. And he was so... I mean, the thing about Julian was so out there and thinking he was doing a good thing, it was almost sentimental. Koons seemed insidious. And here was a guy that we knew was doing these sort of neo-Duchampian ready-mades. He was someone who went to art school, but when he got to New York, went to work for the Museum of Modern Art in New York in their membership department. He broke a record selling memberships. Broke a record. Then he became a part-time stock trader, and here he was making... His first show at the new museum was called The New, and it consisted of these pristine Hoover vacuum cleaners. A kind of ironic comment on his elders, the minimalists, whose work was so pristine and crisp and clear. What's cleaner than a vacuum cleaner inside of a perfectly clean, hermetic plexiglass box? And you know, there are people, he has a huge retrospective at the Whitney right now, and there are people who feel Koons is the most important artist of the 80s. I'm not ready to go there, but he's certainly up there.
It's funny, I haven't read that much about him, his work having a sense of humor. But when you're talking about the clean and the Hoover, that makes sense. The piece that's in the show, the basketball, total equilibrium, floating there, to me that has a sense of humor because the basketball is a Dr. J basketball, the great Julius Irvin, who was the master of the dunk. And you have this ball dunked in water. And that's never really brought up with Koons too much, is it?
His humor is a bizarre kind of humor. I think I would address that to the Buster Keaton piece. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some people here old enough to remember who Buster Keaton was. Buster Keaton was a silent comedian. I mean, in the silent era, comedian. And he was hilariously funny, but he never smiled, ever. And so he would do this slapstick thing, and you'd kind of laugh for a second, then he wouldn't be smiling, and you'd go, am I supposed to be laughing? And it's like Koons. I think Buster Keaton is a self-portrait of Koons. It's sort of like when you look at a Koons, you kind of laugh for a second, and you go, wait a minute. Am I supposed to be laughing? And that's where he catches you with that and the seduction of his materials. But there's definitely a humor to Koons. It's just you're not sure whether it's a good humor or a bad humor.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should open it to questions at this point. So if anyone has any questions. Now, yes?
Do you still hate Koons?
No. No, I don't hate Koons. I don't love him, but I don't hate him. And I have met him a number of times. He's an eerily icy guy. I mean, when you know, meet him, he shakes your hand, he looks you right in the eye, and big smile. Hi, Michael. I mean, there's like nothing gentle or natural. There's nothing natural about Koons. He's just like his art. Yeah. Complete, eerily unnatural. Deeply superficial, as Warhol.
And he wasn't the most disliked artist. I think David Sally probably was for a while.
Yes.
Schnabel.
No, Sally. David Sally.
Yeah, yeah.
David Sally,
yeah.
For sure.
Who was, let's see, I think we have a David Sally. Mm-hmm. I must have missed it.
No, I don't.
I think we have official.
Oh, we didn't have one in here?
Yeah. We have Eric Fischel.
Okay.
Yeah.
We hated him, so. We didn't like him. Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
There's something about Kunz that he never touched his artwork, that he had other people assemble it for him. Is that true?
Yes.
He has about 150 assistants who work with him, mainly on computers.
His work.
Well, his work is so shiny you'd put a fingerprint on it if you touched it. I mean, that's how it's so pristine you wouldn't touch it.
And that's, you know, that's kind of a bit of humor too, because it's
is.
A play on Brancusi, mm-hmm. who always went around and even polished his
right.
works, and the idea of making it so pristine. Way in the back.
Yeah, I have a question about periodization. When did you think the 80s began in New York, and when did they finish?
Well, I'll just say a few comments and then let Andrea and Allison talk. It's funny in doing this show, if depending on who you talk to and what their age is, a decade, it's a very good question about when a decade actually begins and when a decade ends. I mean, I think Andrea and Allison often see the 80s almost from a 90s viewpoint. They look at the late 80s and then what happened into the 90s. For me, the 80s really began around 78. And that's when a lot of these people moved to New York. They came of age. And so I see the 80s deadly situated around 1985, 86, 87. But anyway, you guys.
Well, and when Michael and I had, he, you know, it's his exhibition, but we had a lot of discussions about who should could potentially be in or not be in. And I would say Katie Nolan, and he would say, no, that's, I associate that with 90s. But if you look at her career, it started in the 80s, and I don't know. You know, there it is different for everyone, and the same maybe with someone like Lorna Simpson. I think most of us associate her with the 90s, but the career started in the 80s. I was, you know, I was shaky on when it started, and it didn't start in the 70s for me. It probably started in the 80s and ends in the early 90s, so a little bit after Michael.
I think in doing research on CoLab and working on the ephemera room, they really got started in the late 70s, and so I can really see that shift in their work and in that spirit of showing outside of the art institution and their concerns. So, I mean, it's hard to say looking back at it now, but dates are arbitrary, mm-hmm. decades are arbitrary, same with music.
Right.
There's a fluidity with that, but I do see it coming into the 1990s as well.
Yeah, there were some new figuration shows in the very late 70s.
Sure.
It led to, it partly led to so-called neo-expressionism.
I mean, for me also, I mean, to put a slightly dark side to it and sad side was, I mean, Bob Mapplethorpe died in like 1989. Mm-hmm. To me, that was the end of the 80s. He was a 70s artist who transferred Warhol into the 80s and, you know, and he died of AIDS. And, you know, AIDS was a huge part of the 80s. And the 90s become, in my mind, much more surreal and very quiet. It's a quiet decade. It'll be interesting to see who does the 90s show and how that works out. I hand that to you.
89's an interesting year because the Berlin Wall falls.
Right.
Sarah's Tilted Arc is mm-hmm. removed. There's no neocon conspiracy, I don't think. But it's a nice kind of end mm-hmm. to that decade.
Culture wars yeah. also.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you talking about me?
Yes.
During Reagan, I mean, I lived in New York in the 80s. And in 87, there was a little bit of a financial drop in the stock market. And I remember it really, it seemed big then, but that's when you started hearing sort of the art market crashing and all this stuff.
It did. It did. Around 87, 88, there was a crash. And actually a big one. You're right. You know, 2008 here was, you know, as close to the mm-hmm. to the 1929 crash that we had in America as you can get. And the art market did not skip a beat. Mm-hmm. But in 87, it really crashed. It came back. It came back rapidly, but it did crash. And it affected a lot of careers, particularly some of the big ticket items. You know, Julian Schnabel was selling out shows. David Sally was selling out shows. All of these things happened. And the big discussion was, what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're living the high life, you know. And this was a discussion I had with Richard Armstrong, who's now the director of the Guggenheim, and a lot of people. And somebody said to me, they'll just make smaller things. And that's what they did. Yeah. They dropped the scale down because, you know, paintings are priced by size. So they did. They started making smaller things.
Yes.
Can you speak more about the Gorilla Girls, and are they still around? What happened to them? Did they remain anonymous? Or?
They're still active, actually. Pharrell Williams did a show at Gallery Perrotin this year, and they actually did the same poster that we saw here, but it's related to the way women are represented in music videos, which I think is an interesting take. So they are still active and still anonymous.
Still anonymous.
There was a yes.
And I wanted to ask, could you tell us more about Grand Jury and just the decision to include that in that section too?
Well, to me, it was really important to have AIDS represented in this exhibition because, you know, it's hard for you and a lot of people in this audience because of your age to understand what the AIDS epidemic was like in New York, in America. But in New York in particular, I mean, if you look at New York culture, fashion, design, art, music, 75% of it was gay people. And here was this epidemic. Imagine Ebola in Manhattan. Every half hour, somebody died of AIDS. And now it's hard for anybody to believe because we almost have a cure for it. I mean, it seems like it's so much in the past. For some people, though, it is not in the past. And I had someone come up to me at the opening who was very upset and actually thought AIDS should have been more represented in this show. So,
also about Nan Goldin's Ballad of Sexual Dependency. She wrote an epilogue to that work in the 90s, and she talks about how it really is a eulogy to all of the images you see all in those 70 photographs in the exhibition, because almost all are no longer alive, and most of them have died from complication with AIDS. So that, too, speaks to that part of the 1980s.
And there was this is also going to be hard for you to believe, but there was a point in the early 80s, if you were straight, you felt like the other in New York. It was the first time I had ever felt like the other. Like, I'm a minority here in this world, in this New York, in Manhattan, you know. And then all of a sudden that happened. So there were these huge psychological shifts that were taking place in New York. That you just don't have now. It's just a different world now. But
yeah. Maybe one more question.
Well, the thing you mentioned about the male artists coming in and trying to revive the painting, and there was sort of a macho persona attached to this. Was this related to the sort of macho tilt of the original Abex people of several decades before? And what was the overall effect on the status of women in the art market as a result of this macho pose that you talked about?
You should show the Eric Fisher.
Yeah, okay.
Let's see this represents the whole thing you're talking about, this image Mark's going to pull up. It did, of course, relate to abstract expressionism and these male artists feeling they wanted to revitalize painting, to bring painting back to its stellar condition in the huge scale. And it's ironic to me, and I've said it to a number of people, you know, as women artists became stronger and more a part of the art world, the male artist paintings got bigger, which is what men do. And this is a painting by Eric Fischel called Bad Boy. And you have a woman, it could be his mother or his sister, laying in bed naked with her legs spread apart. And this young teenager is talking with her. She's fiddling with her toenails. But you can see that from behind this, he's stealing money from her purse. To me, this is not as much a Freudian image as a sociological image. Who's in control? Who's controlling her? Who? Is it the female controlling the male, and is the male frightened by this? And you could really, I've talked to Eric Fischel about this, I've talked to Julian Schnabel about it. They were very, very aware of women becoming a much more prominent part of the art world, and it made him nervous. It's as simple as that. No. I don't know what there is to say.
I don't know. You said it.
Yeah. Well, on that note, thank you all for coming. Enjoy the show. It's a terrific show if you haven't seen it, and I hope this piqued your curiosity if you haven't.